Welcome to the Autism Roundtable. I'm Leah Gross, founder of Circle Care Services. I'll bring you autism experts from all kinds of fields for helpful parenting ideas, insights, and strategies. Tune in for learning and support and connection. Welcome, Kara, to the Autism Roundtable. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, Leah. I'm really looking forward to hearing what you have to say and having a conversation about autism.
Okay, so if you could start by just introducing yourself, tell us a little bit about what your experience has been and your relationship to the autism world.
Okay, I'll try to keep it condensed.
You actually have a lot of interesting stuff, so you don't have to keep it condensed. Go ahead. Tell us all about it.
Thank you. I am a registered nurse who's been working in mental health for about 22 years. I've worked in various settings. I've worked with kids in an inpatient setting. I've worked with adults in inpatient settings. I've worked in the emergency room when folks come in mental health crisis. I've been a care manager for people on, in North Carolina, we call it the Innovations Waiver. It's for people with Medicaid that have disabilities. So a lot of my caseload was autistic with co-occurring medical conditions, a lot of times epilepsy. I've worked in rehab. I've worked in children's rehab. Just lots of hands-on good experience. I was a camp counselor, or actually I was the RN for Camp Lakey Gap for autistic individuals for 4 years. And so every week was a new set of campers. So I got to check in a bunch of different, you know, meds and meet a lot of people and their families through that process and kind of see what parents' approaches were to medications in the summer. It was pretty fascinating and to get to know their kids and how well water regulates dysregulation. We had pool time 3 times a day. Also, the last 8 years, I've been working as an autism advocate and consultant. And I do a lot of public speaking, a lot of trainings. And some of those trainings are for therapy offices or for psychiatrist offices. Because I'll just tell you a little brief aside. When I worked at the rehab hospital, this is for neurotypical people, adults. I was good friends with one of the psychiatrists who'd been there for 30 years. So 5 days a week for 30 years, he'd been doing intakes on patients and submitting them and or admitting them into the units. It's a 120-bed hospital. And I was like, so how many do you think you've done? He gave me a rough estimate, which was literally 10,000 or more people. And I was like, how many of those people had autism? And he said, well, none of them. I was like, well, if the statistic, which at the time was 1 in 68, is 1 in 68, what are the chances that none of them had autism? And it was lovely because he said, obviously, I don't know enough about autism. And I really want more reactions like that from the community. It's lovely. But to cap all that off, or not to cap it off necessarily, but I got my diagnosis as level 1 autistic in my early to mid-30s. And it was life-changing for me and very much contextualized a lot of things.
Okay, so I want to just talk about that for a minute. So tell us a little bit about what your personal history was, why you went for the diagnosis, and why that was sort of revealing to you and helpful to you in knowing that you had that diagnosis.
Sure. So I went for the diagnosis because I come from the healthcare model where if you don't have a diagnosis, you aren't going to get medicated properly, nor will you get the proper care. So, for instance, if someone came in with dissociative identity disorder but was labeled as bipolar, we would be giving them the wrong treatment. So, and it can actually make the dissociative identity disorder much, which used to be multiple personality, it could be much, much worse. So right treatment is really important, as is right medication. And medication is a choice that everybody gets to make. I'm not saying it 100% has to happen, but the idea of not being diagnosed didn't really occur to me. It was difficult to get diagnosed. it took a lot of calling, a lot of burnout, and like just putting it aside because I couldn't deal with it anymore until I managed to get an appointment. I think it was 18 months out. So, and that was back before autism was a kind of a niche diagnosis and as identified as it is now. So even then, it was a really long wait to get someone who knew autism in adults as well. Getting a pediatric diagnosis, at least an educational one in North Carolina, if you ask for evaluation, it takes 60 days. Legally, they have to have your child assessed in 60 days. The school system does. And they also have to absorb the cost of that. So that educational assessment, and this is a little bit of a soapbox and a little bit of a tangent, but I think that's okay.
No, that's okay. It's very interesting. And I do think that we have listeners out there that are definitely going through this process, deciding on this process. So I think it's very informative.
That educational diagnosis you get from the school, you can decide if you want to tell providers like your doctor or their therapist about it. It's not a medical diagnosis. So you're not really boxing your kid. It's a diagnosis that the OTs and the folks like yourself and are making. And it's very valid. It's just not a medical diagnosis. So there's no stigma, so to speak, that's going to follow you around. Like having an educational assessment done that identifies autism as a needs area wouldn't rule out your family moving to Australia. Like if a doctor diagnosed your child with autism, there are places on the planet where you can't move. You can visit, but you can't immigrate there. So
with an autism diagnosis, they do not allow for immigration there.
Yes.
Wow.
And there are places
that's a new nugget of information.
Yeah, there's places with socialized medicine where they're not willing to absorb costs. I think if you can prove your ability to financially support yourself, they'll make exceptions. And it's not many. It's maybe five different places. So, but it is getting a diagnosis, I think, is really important to identity, to a sense of, it is different for me. There are things that are going to be harder. And if I continue to try to make them easier, it's energy that I could have used and things I can actually change to change those things and to be happier in that arena. So knowing where to put your focus, for me, I think is really important as far as progressing to a place where you can be more functional within the limitations of my autism. That's been my story. I don't want to put that on anyone else.
Wow. Okay. Now you speak about like level one. So talk to us a little bit about what are the different levels and what might they implicate and what has it implicated for you in your life? And like sort of what I've heard from a lot of different individuals with autism is that like they almost then felt relieved that they now fit into something. So explain the diagnosis, the range if possible, and then how that
follows you. I'll back us up a little bit, and if it's okay to talk about the DSM so you can know where this information is coming from. So the DSM is a diagnostic manual. It's for mental health. We would normally have said disorders, but I would like to say differences. It's kind of like the physician's desk reference is the guide to physical ailments that and a doctor would go through that and kind of try to figure out what was physically wrong with you based on symptoms. The DSM is a manual that they've been publishing since, I think the 70s, that is a big book, a big dictionary of mental health challenges and definitions of each of those mental health challenges, like what criteria you have to meet to be bipolar, what criteria you have to meet to be depressed. Just to make it super easy, for instance, if you were in a situation where you had a parent die and you were depressed for 6 or 7 weeks, you would not be clinically depressed. You'd be situationally depressed. So you wouldn't meet the criteria for a diagnosis of long-term moderate to severe depression. You would be in situational depression. So it's important that we have these delineations, A, so we don't over-medicate people, B, so we don't over-pathologize them to where they end up getting stuck in the system. and see so that we all have a common language that as practitioners we can use that's kind of shorthand. I'm sure you've heard this. If you've met one person with autism, you've met one person with autism. And one of the reasons that is because autism has three levels. It's a very complex disorder, and it manifests differently depending on your personality, your trauma, your financial situations, your access to resources, what type of therapist you've been working with, or therapies you've had access to. So according to the DSM, and the most recent version of the DSM came out a few years ago, and they've revised the autism diagnosis a little bit. The 2013 edition took what used to be Asperger's disorder, which was kind of autism light. It was autism with minimal need for outside supports. So, for instance, maybe I'll use myself as an example. You know, I'm able to work short periods of time during the day, depending on how much I want to push myself into burnout. I can hold a job for a period of time that is full time. At the same time, if I'm working, I can't feed myself. I spend so much energy on my job that I can't think through the steps of how to get myself a meal. So I just wouldn't. And so that would be considered level one autism. So you need support with certain areas, and you always will. Yeah, but so it used to be Asperger's, and a lot of people don't like the fact that their Asperger's that they had their whole life is suddenly autism. And they'll still use the word Aspie. The reason we changed Asperger's to autism is kind of complex, but the one that I think is the most important is some paperwork came out from Germany. It was released to the public that proved that Asperger, the doctor who identified the disorder, actually signed death certificates for people in concentration camps with disabilities, including kids with Asperger's. So his perspective was that people with Asperger's had nothing to contribute to society. And this is his perspective on paper, and who knows what duress he was under when he signed it. And also, this is, we can only know history from what we're left with. So the idea that someone who thinks that we are useless to society is his name is what we're identifying our diagnosis with isn't something that is mentally healthy.
Not healthy. And it is really awesome to listen and hear how you are working, you're clearly very educated, you come to the table with so much and a wealth of knowledge, and you're saying that you're on the autism spectrum or that you in the olden days would have been Asperger's. And I just love to hear this because I think it's like very empowering to everyone out there that you could take that diagnosis and learn from it and learn how to better structure your day, better, you know, understand what it is that is stopping you from being successful and then putting things in place. Once you got that diagnosis, well, I'm a little bit jumping because I don't know if you finished the DSM-5.
I can give you a quick on that. So
let's finish that and then I want to hear.
Each level just means you need more supports. So someone with level 2 autism might need to live in a group home. Or they might need someone with them, you know, like a one-to-one support in the morning to help them sequence getting ready to go to their, it would likely be a volunteer situation, but something that gives their life meaning. Someone with level 3 autism would definitely need a one-on-one person for most activities during the day. They would need help getting dressed. They would need help knowing to brush their teeth. They would need help, you know, more than just visual cueing. They might need hand over hand for some things. So it's just a level of needs. And to be very clear, people with level 3 may be just as intelligent as people with level 1. They just don't have the verbal skills to express themselves a lot of the times, and they may not have the executive functioning capacity to figure out how to express their intelligence. So we need to be very clear that just because someone has level 3 autism doesn't mean they're ignorant, and it doesn't mean they don't understand what's going on around them.
Right, and doesn't mean they don't have emotions.
Absolutely, yeah, no. And personalities that are lovely to get to know, and just get to know them in a very different way.
Yeah, that's great. Now, in order to qualify for the diagnosis, what are like some main key points that a doctor is looking at?
So you're looking at one thing I want to really zone in on is asymmetrical development. So you may, I knew how to read when I was 3. I didn't learn to tie my shoes till 6th grade. So there's some areas of excel and there's some areas of deficit. And it's very, so that's why it's really hard to tell what a child or an adult on the spectrum needs, because they may look incredibly competent. For instance, right now, autism is my special interest. So I come off as usually competent. Whereas if you put me in a room with 5 strangers and ask me to make small talk about soccer practice, I may as well be sitting in the corner, like facing the corner. I don't know what to do. And that's okay. That's just part of my personality. I've learned to avoid those situations or to have a plan going in. That's the different layers of affect as far as that goes. And I think I kind of lost track of the thread there, if you don't mind to pull me back in to what you're asking.
No, just we're going through what are common symptoms that doctors are looking for when making a diagnosis.
For asymmetrical development, difficulties with social interactions, as I just mentioned, fixation on interests. Fixation isn't a nice word. I think we're trying to come up with another more friendly word, but we'll just use that for now. Fixation on special interests, or interests that take you away from being able to have connection with other humans in a typical way. For instance, if I'm speaking about autism, as I said, I'm very comfortable. I love engaging. I can talk to 500 people and I'm fine. If the topic is plants, I kind of come in and out. It doesn't give me a dopamine hit in the same way. So it's one of the reasons why it's so important for occupational therapists to integrate special interests, not as a reward, but as a teaching tool. For instance, I have a client that I work with that's 10 that likes, I have a lot of them that like Lego. I love Lego. But not you get to play with Lego if you do this, but like, how can we use Lego? Let's watch the Lego movie when I'm not seeing you. And then when we get back together, let's talk about the different characters in the Lego movie and how do you think they felt about each other? So, and let's look at a clip. And okay, so in this clip, how do you think Emmett felt when he was underneath that washer dryer and all alone for all that time passing? So, you know, it's really about, if what you're discussing or what you're trying to teach someone on the spectrum doesn't spark joy for them, it's going to be hard. Why make something hard if we can find a way to make it easy?
Yeah. And I also think that it's important for us to understand the way the autistic brain works so that then we could be that much more successful in our treatments and in creating positive structures of days and picking proper jobs that individuals with autism feel that much more successful. So when, like, as a child looking back, like, what do you wish you could tell parents about how they should be focusing their energies towards therapies, towards I don't want to use the word, but it's out there, right? Sort of like fixing them or putting them in the best situations possible, right? As parents, we always want to like make the best environment for our children and we want to support them. Like, what kind of supports would you recommend for a parent, like in their perspective to how they should best support their child with autism?
So I'm going to go for the where should they focus first? My first thing would be, what is your goal for your child? Do you want your child to be, do you need your life to look normal? Like, are you in that mindset of my life needs to look as normal as possible? Because if so, that's one set of goals. If your mindset is, I want to be realistic about my child's happiness and capacity to connect to other people, so that I know they'll be loved after I'm gone, That's a whole different set of goals. So which set of goals are you working towards? And quite honestly,
I'm going to say that let's go down each path together, because I'm sure we have different people on different paths. So let's go through the normal one first. And then second, we'll go through the fly free and be you path, which I think there's a, we could, even on the looking normal end of things, I do think there's recommendations we can give that just like to give a perspective to parents of, you know, how could I best support my child within a neurotypical world, which, you know,
keeping them from being bullied, like giving them skills that will keep them from being bullied is important. Also, them knowing what to do when they are bullied is very important. So going down the path of what we've normally traditionally done is we have tried to alter the organic behavior to meet the developmental milestones as are laid out for the neurotypical brain. We want you to be able to do this at 7, this at 8, this in first grade, this in third grade, because the other kids are doing that. The issue with that is asymmetrical development, and the brain, the neurotype of autism doesn't work that way. But we can try to push our children that way by creating our goals of like, okay, well, I really want you to use this fork correctly and stop eating with your hands. Okay. That's not my client. Like that's not the families that I would work with, but also it's valid. It's going to make perhaps you more comfortable at the dinner table, but the mental load of pretending and remembering what's been told to you to do that goes against your internal desires and what feels good to you may make it so that child can't eat out at a restaurant because they're too uncomfortable with these new ways of eating. Also, like from my perspective, like what many cultures eat with their hands. Like, it's very American to like think we need utensils. And, you know, if your kid won't wash his hands, obviously you want him to use utensils just to minimize, you know, germs. But so like that would be a traditional thing would be teach your child to eat with a fork. The modality of I want my child to feel comfortable and with their own brain and like their brain can tell them things that are correct would be, yeah, right now, my 7-year-old wants to eat with their hands.
All
right. Like, it's not really hurting anybody. Yeah, it's embarrassing a little bit when we go out to eat, but we can go out to eat because he's comfortable. Or she. It's a trade-off. And, you know, it's a trade-off that works differently for different families. And, you know, I'm definitely not saying all situations.
Okay, so
the model.
So I hear you're going down the path of let a child or teenager that has their deficits sort of incorporate that into their lifestyle and let them be comfortable with who they are, and then sort of just pick out their strengths and highlight those strengths and sort of let them fly with that, because their strengths are probably very, very strong, and there's what to for them to contribute to the world if we allow them to be themselves in this world.
Sure. Like, people aren't going to think your child's quote unquote normal because they know how to use a fork. There are way, way more like overt signs that we're autistic than being able to mimic neurotypical behavior. It's neurological. It's like trying to teach someone who's a diabetic to eat cake. I mean, you can, they're just going to need a ton of insulin. You can teach someone who's autistic to look neurotypical, but they're getting a ton of medication and a ton of therapy. And again, therapy's good. Like, it's helpful to get to know yourself better. I've been very privileged to have access to a lot of therapy my whole life, even before I had the autism diagnosis, because I've needed assistance, right? Like, I do have autism. I'm going to need help forever. And that's one of the things with autism becoming a trend diagnosis that's a little upsetting is you don't suddenly get autism. If you haven't been struggling your whole life, it's likely it's OCD and some combination of like ADHD. Like, it's likely it's not autism. There has to be a developmental delay that is persistent from childhood through adulthood that no amount of medication or therapy can quote unquote fix. Although you can, you can look quote unquote more normal or less normal based, you know, having an early interventions is important for that. And I do think that there's a time and place for learning the neurotypical rules. Like you can't hit people. That's not a choice. That's like people have the right to be hit, you know. But teaching your child to identify when they're getting overwhelmed by knowing what situations overwhelm them can make it to where they know how to control themselves before they get into an emotional state where they're going to hit. And that's probably the only way to really do that besides medicating them really heavily. And that you obviously, like, the, you know, a five-year-old's brain, a neurotypical five-year-old only understands 25% of what's going on. So if we have these early interventions, we have to keep in mind, like, their brain's not, even if they were neurotypical, it's not developed. And we have to have a reasonable expectation of timeline as they get older. You know, we talk about being able to look. I can tell kids who've had ABA because they, when I meet them, will say their name. They'll shake my hand or they'll say, they'll introduce themselves. Or if I introduce myself, they'll say their name back. Neurotypical kids a lot of times don't do that. Like, COVID has made a huge impact and on socialization for children. And I volunteer at one of my old foster kiddos' schools. And if I introduce myself to her classmates, most times they get uncomfortable. And she's in first grade. If they parrot back a neurotypical adult response, I immediately kind of clue into watching their behavior to see if they have sensory issues, to see, are there areas where I can be helpful to the teacher in keeping this kid regulated? Because it's likely that they've had some sort of ABA or at least speech therapy. So it's a very long
answer. Okay, so bringing it back to what type of sort of system or support should a parent go after when they're like, what, like if you were giving a plan and you saying let the child fly free, but obviously every child needs some sort of guidance in life, so where would you provide that guidance, where would you provide that therapy, and where would you say let this child just be and they'll develop and let them be their own person?
So if their behavior isn't hurting themselves or anyone else and is still respectful of other people's autonomy, right? And then I think it's fine. You know, if it's a behavior that's, I get what I want whenever I want it because I'm on the spectrum, that's not healthy. That's not how the world works for anyone. And if your child comes to expect that because that's how they've been raised, they're going to have a really hard time connecting with people in the future because no one's going to want to be around that. So if it's a psychological issue or challenge, I think having some training is very appropriate. If it's a physiological response, they can't help it. We can't help it. If I am talking to somebody and an ambulance goes by, I'm going to stop talking and not know what we were talking about. You could try giving me techniques and tips all day long, but my nervous system just got engaged, which released cortisol into my body, which released, you know, my blood pressure went up. The blood went from my head to my large muscles so I can run. Like, you can't change a physiological response. You can't change a meltdown. You can change a tantrum. If there's something the child wants that will stop the behavior, like, I want this, you're in Walmart. I want this toy. And then they have big emotions and big behaviors. That's not a meltdown. That's a tantrum. And it's okay to hold some boundaries around that because you're not always going to get what you want. If for no reason at all that you can tell they're on the ground, it's likely that their brain is overstimulated by the lights, the noise, the number of colors of the items on the shelves, the other people. The hum from the refrigerator units, the hum from the fluorescent light, like that's their brain having a response. You can't train that out of somebody any more than you can, you know, stop someone from having a stroke. So understanding the difference between physiology and psychological reactions that are normal for children developmentally and normal to have to parent is really important. And honestly, the only people who can really identify that are other autistic professionals. There are people in the field now that are on the spectrum like myself that when Lawson is one that comes to mind, he's brilliant. He has come up with a whole new theory of autism, the monotropic theory, the idea that we focus on one thing at a time, and if you try to break that focus, it's dysregulating to our nervous systems. Temple Grandin, like we have some real leaders in the industry and in the emotional unraveling of what autism is, and we never have had that before. Because up until the 70s, if your child was diagnosed with autism, it was usually young, and you were told by physicians, by pediatricians, that your best choice was to institutionalize that child because it was going to destroy your family. And mothers did this because they were told to do it. And we didn't know. We weren't given space as autistics to develop our minds because we were put in a situation where we were hosed down twice a day and medicated, and that was pretty much our life. So this is a whole new generation. We've never had older autistic people. Get on, my recommendation would be get on Facebook, get on Reddit, get on the computer, find people in your area that have autistic children, if you're a parent, whether they're 5-year-old children or 45-year-old children. Who do they use? Especially if they have adult children, they know who doesn't work, right? So network with your community to find resources of people who are neurodivergent affirming that understand if we just keep telling your child, no matter how old they are, that they're wrong and they need to do it different, they're going to hate how they work. They're going to hate who they are. And that's part of why suicide is the second leading cause of death in people with autism. And we, on average, have a life expectancy of 15 years shorter than neurotypical people. If you're always told you're wrong, you can't have a whole lot of sense of self-esteem. So,
yeah. And I feel like today's day and age, self-esteem comes before education. We have to make sure our children are feeling good about themselves because it is very scary. It's a hard world out there, and children that don't feel good about themselves are not successful. It's a building block for learning.
Yeah, and they're little extremists too because their brains aren't developed, right? So like the suicide rate in the U.S. for children ages 10 to 17 has doubled in the last 20 years. There's a problem with that. There's a huge problem with that. And we try to, I don't know, as a society, I think, not to go too big with this, but we tend to push under the people who kill themselves. It's a problem that takes care of itself through the eyes of government. But it's not, because we're leaving people in pain and we're leaving people suffering. And it's not okay for any 10-year-old to commit suicide. Like, to have that level of hopelessness at 10 is heartbreaking, and it should be heartbreaking, and it should be something we talk about more. And that's neurotypical kids, not autistic kids, that theta.
Right. And I do think that part of parenting and part of being a support to your child in 2025 is that we have to really focus on making each individual child feel good about who they are, looking at their positive qualities, and really verbalizing to them why we think they are so important, because it's important for them to feel good about themselves and feel valued in the world.
I will say, I agree 100%.
Okay. Yeah.
But just one more thing. It is important for those of us on the spectrum to do things we're bad at. I know as a child, I avoided anything that had to do with a sport or a ball. My interoception and proprioception were terrible. And I didn't have OT or anything like that, PT. So
I was going to say, come see me. I'll help you with that.
Yeah. I appreciate that. It's really hard to find OTs that'll take adults here anyway. So I would avoid. I would read books instead of going to the cafeteria to eat. I would go to the lunch or to the library and read. It didn't really prepare me for having conversations with coworkers as an adult. And I wish someone had monitored that choice for me, because it was an easy choice, but it wasn't necessarily the best choice. So yeah, go ahead. I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt your flow there.
So that it is really kind of a hard balance for parents, because we want to give our children all the opportunity that we possibly can. And we do want to push children into maybe their uncomfortable zone so that they could learn the skills. But I like how you delineated like physiological responses and really looking out for those signs of an individual going into the zone of this is my body responding versus this is my behavior responding, and really to respect the body response and understand when it's happening, so that you know when punishment or when giving sort of pushing a child to a certain direction is the proper way to go versus when this is out of my control. I can't make a positive change here. So give me my time and give me my space.
Yeah. Or at least let's get some wins under your belt before you ask for something hard. Like every time you have a success, your brain releases dopamine, right? So if you're trying to do something really, really hard, and it may be a valid thing to parent, like, you know, your kid, you're an expert in your kid. Try to give them some wins, like ask them to do two things you know they can do before you ask them to do something that they may not be able to do, so that they have some, you're kind of tricking the brain into giving it chemical reserves to pull from so that the meltdown is less likely, or the overwhelm. So yeah, that's
I love that. In my therapy sessions, I always try my best to do something similar to that. Like if a child, let's say we're working on handwriting, I'll always do a couple things that are easier for the child that then I'm able to say, whoa, you did so great. And then, you know, we'll do one or two things that are a little more challenging. And when they're frustrated, we're able to say, yeah, but you were great at that. And you will one day be great at this too. So really, I love that thought too for parents, to try and give children tasks that are easy enough to be successful in, so that when they have the hard tasks, it doesn't sort of take that hit to their self-confidence.
And Leah, you kind of hit on something that is also, I think, essential for a parent to understand. Just because, I will use your example, just because in your office, in a controlled, familiar environment, a child can write neatly, doesn't mean at school, with the chaos of other kids and being told directions and changing classes and different smells, and they're going to be able to focus enough to have as neat a handwriting as they might on their homework. So practicing the skill when it's not in a sensory time where there's sensory overwhelm, and letting the child know it's okay. It doesn't mean you can't do this anymore if you hit a situation where you're not able to access it. Obviously, you wouldn't use those words for a child, but in languaging they can understand. You aren't going to be able to do all the time. Like you can learn breathing techniques to calm you down at home when you're mad at your sister, and you can be really, really good at them, but it doesn't mean that you failed if you can't do it at school. It's just, it's harder there because there's more going on. And it's an opportunity to have a conversation about what things are overwhelming. Again, we're talking mostly about small kids, but about the school environment for them. And I think those opportunities to validate, that's a lot for your brain to process. Yeah, I hear you. When you're sitting next to two kids that have ADHD and you have autism, which is oftentimes how we kind of tend to table up our kids for some reason, as we put our autistic kids and our ADHD kids together, it's going to be hard for you to focus. And that doesn't mean you also have ADHD. It means you're autistic, you're monotropic, and your people with ADHD have focus issues that are on the exact opposite end. They're polytropic. They're focusing on multiple things at once, and they can't focus on one thing at once. So I think that's a good thing for teachers to remember. Just because there's a neurodivergent similarity doesn't mean there's going to be an educational connection. And in fact, you could undermine the ability for the autistic child to be educated by putting them with other kids who have atypical brain types that aren't their brain type. And that's, you know, I'm not a teacher to disclose, but I think it's important to think about.
Really great points. Okay, while we're on the physiological responses, what is your thoughts on stimming and how we should address that?
Absolutely. Thank you so much for asking that, Leah. So traditionally, we have tried to, the neurotypical paradigm has tried to use behavioralism to put stimming in a place of extinction to where people don't stim anymore. And for some people, it's really important. Some parents, it's really important their kids don't stim because it does bring attention. It does create a fear in the parent of bullying. That's valid. It's 100% valid. I don't want to discount that. Also, stimming, it's been proved, releases dopamine in the brain. Stimming is a child's or an autistic person's way of trying to find balance and calm. With some of my teenagers that I work with, I'll teach them to, we call it shrink the stim. So you stim in a smaller way. So instead of flapping hands, can you take your fingernail, your thumbnail, and rub it against your pointer finger? Because you can do that under your desk. It's a stim, but it's not anything that's going to get you bullied because no one's going to notice it. Well, teenagers aren't going to notice it. They're too self-focused. I would say if you're at home and your child's stimming, what would it be like to sit down next to them and just mimic their stim to meet them where they're at? I feel comfortable trying that. I'm not saying everyone has to, but it can be very liberating. And sometimes with my level two kids, the best thing I can do is get on the floor. If they come in dysregulated and they don't want to be there, put out something that I have in my office that's their special interest, sit down next to them and just mirror exactly what they're doing. Eventually they'll engage with the object, and then that engagement with the object will lead to an engagement with me as I engage with the object with them. So it's a resonating sort of thing.
Wow. Okay, so break it down for us. What is going on in the child that they are looking to stim?
What is going on is they're having a nervous system response. They're either, their body is recognizing something as a threat, and it could be a noise, it could be a color, it could be words, it could be the volume of your voice. Then the autistic brain is very sensitive. We have differences that can be shown on functional MRI in the amygdala, which is the fear center of the brain. So many, many studies have shown many, many times, we process information that is not a threat as a threat. So what's a neurotypical brain is just somebody making eye contact with you for no reason. To an autistic brain is, what? Why are they doing that? Did they want something for me? There's a response that I'm supposed to have that I need to look them back in the eye, and I don't want to look them back in the eye because it's an anxiety cascade that's being triggered by that overactive, overwired amygdala. So there are things there are medications we can do to mute that. There are breathing exercises we can do to mute that activate the vagus nerve, which slows down the heart rate. And that tricks the body into thinking there's no threat. But if we get agitated when they're agitated, they're only going to get more agitated. If my nervous system is dysregulated and I'm at a place where I'm stimming and like someone almost starts asking me even questions like, well, I don't understand why this is overwhelming for you. Like, I'm just going to get more overwhelmed. I'm not going to have any sense of peace. I've found that people trying to help a lot of times is even worse. Because being asked questions, I don't have access to my frontal cortex, the part of your brain that is your intelligent brain, that controls your executive functioning. And autism is a communication and social disorder. So you're asking me to do the two things that pathologically I can't do, be social and communicate, when my brain is hijacked by my nervous system and my amygdala reaction. It doesn't make any sense from a biological perspective. What makes sense is to decrease the stimulation and to bring calm. That can be with an attachment object. A lot of kids get really, like, their fidgets. It's not even the fidgeting, it's having the fidget and the fidget being consistent. It's always the same. It feels the same. It sounds the same when you spin it, when you squish it. Like, so for a parent, regardless of how old your child or your adult child is on the spectrum, the best thing you can do to help calm their nervous system down, if they're in overwhelm or meltdown, is to reduce the demands you're putting on them. It's perfectly fine, in my perspective, and, you know, people have different... I have a table in my office, kids go under that table all the time. I actually put a blanket over that table. So like if they want to go under that table and have a session with me while they're under that table, it's fine. I don't have a problem with that. You don't have, not only do you not have to like eye contact with me, you don't even need to look at me. And it can make, it can engender a sense of safety that allows you to have much deeper, more meaningful conversations than if they're having to follow the neurotypical rules of what connection looks like.
So at, in a home setting where you're not, say, trying to have your child look neurotypical and you're comfortable with them stimming, let them do their stimming, put them in places that they feel comfortable, support them in where they're at because you'll have better access to their brain. Now, say you're in a public setting, and I see this all the time, and I'm always like, don't do that. But and the mom says, stop it. So instead of doing the stop it thing, which we know is counterproductive and the child's not really processing that command as anything, I like that idea of what you said of possibly putting, like replace the behavior with either something that's not as sort of distracting to others or noticeable, or maybe giving them an item. Now, talk a little bit more about giving them a consistent item and why that might be helpful.
I call that an attachment object. I'm kind of appropriating that term for my own use. But for instance, I have a lot of challenges with traveling because everything looks different. You don't know what things are going to smell like. You don't know what the sheets are going to have been washed in. You don't know if the toilet is going to run all night long. Like, you can't control the sensory reality. You don't know if there's going to be construction, you know, all the different things. We've all traveled. So I have a little Godzilla is one of my special interests from when I was younger. So I have a little plastic Godzilla that is my transitional object. He goes on vacations with us. And one of the things that I do when I'm starting to get overwhelmed, not when I'm in meltdown, because then it's too late, I can't think of anything, is I take forced perspective pictures of the Godzilla to where it looks like the little 2.5-inch Godzilla is, you know, holding up the obelisk at the end of Key West. And so it gets my mind monotropically focused on one thing. So what you're looking for is the capacity to monotropically focus so that all the other things go away. So you can't pick an attachment object for your child. Your child kind of has to pick it for themselves. I've worked with folks where their attachment objects are anything from literally a stick that they have carried around for years to a Hello Kitty. More often than not, and I just am realizing this now, actually, Leah, they're something that's a throwback to a time of comfort in their childhood. But yeah, like kind of noticing what is something that you're, what are they, you know what your kid's special interest is. They've talked to you about it at length, I'm sure. Like, find something that relates to it. Maybe it's a little type model of the Titanic that you can take apart. A little kiddo that's into the Titanic. But yeah, and like just have that be like really normalized. In fact, your neurotypical kids can do it too. But yeah, everybody picks their travel buddy. They're, you know, you have a special travel item. So yeah, just finding the areas. And I just want to give a shout out to autism parents, like moms and dads. Your life is very complicated and it's very emotionally draining. And we as people on the spectrum don't necessarily see it, especially children, because they're not wired to see it yet. But these are ideal circumstances. If you can't, if you are the parent going, stop it, you're not bad. It's just your brain isn't keeping up with what's being required of it. And that's as much a physiological truth as our physiological truth. You probably don't have time to see a therapist once a week or resources to see a therapist once a week. If you can, please do. Reaching out to other parents through the internet that can understand how hard it is so, so important. And don't think of it as like even taking time for yourself, because we as people on the spectrum need you to take that time for yourself so that you can show up when we need you. We'll take the blame. Think of it as taking time for us to yourself. But yeah, it's really hard what you're doing. And I have so many parents that I work with, that I do parent coaching with, that I have nothing but the highest respect for. And they're the ones that know I'm not going to get it right most days, but some days I am. And that's what we focus on. You know, you're not a bad parent if you love your kid.
So
So
okay, so I'm going to segue right into your parent coaching. So currently you have a private practice where you provide parent coaching. Give us a couple highlights of what you do in your work, messages you give to your parents.
Absolutely. Thank you. So I love working with parents. Parents that go through the process of finding me are usually very motivated, and I'm blessed that way. I feel like so often giving them the data of what's realistic can help them figure out what goals they want to strive for themselves. I love helping them find resources. If they don't want to medicate their kiddos, what are some other things we can do that are better than doing nothing? When do we know it's time to medicate, if it's time to medicate? I am a nurse at heart, so being able to explain, especially for dads, and this may sound sexist, but that's not how I mean it, or people whose brains are wired that way, having the science of it to know it's not about bad parenting. You're not doing anything wrong. Like, this is just like what your child's brain is doing. There's some things that maybe you can do different that might be helpful. And let's figure those out together, because it's going to be different for every kid. And I love getting to spend time with parents over, you know, sometimes folks will see me every 3 or 4 months as like a check-in if there's something significant. They usually tend to see me around puberty. Symptoms that were small, once you throw some estrogen and some testosterone on them, can get much bigger. So a lot of my parents have tween and teen children where they're trying to figure out what of this is normal teen development and hormonal reactions and what of it is autism, because it's gotten awful clunky. And that's really fair. So yeah, finding what could work better, and sometimes what could work better is doing less, which is hard. It seems to be equally as hard for parents as doing more, and maybe even harder. But you know, as a teen, you're supposed to be withdrawing from your parents. You're just self-differentiating, and that's normal. As someone on the spectrum, we know we need help, but we don't want to need help. So it creates this whole like dynamic of like falling behind and like further frustration, and making sure that that child has a therapist that understands autism is essential. So because some of us, because they're just used to dealing with the neurotypical kids and trying to work through that. And this is a whole nother layer of like, no, I'm honestly not ever going to be competent in making myself meals for myself. Like, please don't tell me I'm going to learn that when I'm an adult, because then when I'm an adult and I don't learn that, I feel even worse about myself. And again, that statistic. So anyway, I feel very passionate about working with parents. I do remote visits a lot. I work with folks mostly in the US, but some in Great Britain. We try to work with the time change.
Yeah, that's tough.
And yeah, just really understanding what's physiological. A lot of times parents have traits of autism as well, where they can learn stuff about themselves that ends up being really fun to explore with them. So yeah, I love doing sessions with parents and like kind of facilitating getting them on the same page with each other as well. Because when you live in a family where you have people on the spectrum, especially small children, you probably aren't having a lot of time to connect with your spouse around making a plan around how you want to parent. So like really having a safe space for discussion and like moderating that a little bit. Like, you know, people behave differently when there's someone watching. And I do have 20 years as a psych nurse. So like I can tell when people are getting at a point where they're getting upset about the conversation is let's take a step back. So yeah, I love working with parents. I love working with kids. Professionals, it's a different thing. I get it, like engaging in education is really important. Since the 60s, I'll leave you with this. Since the 60s, neurotypical people have been making decisions for folks on the spectrum in how we have therapy and whether we go to placement or not, and whether we're lobotomized and whether we have our forced sterilization is happening. We've had no autonomy and we die sooner and we take ourselves out. It's not working. We need more collaboration between neurotypical and neuroatypical people, because as hard as it is for neurotypical people to understand people with autism, it's just as hard for people with autism to understand people that are neurotypical. So we got to start working with it.
Yeah, and that's why I think like this conversation is such an amazing conversation and important to get out there, because we need to hear from people on the spectrum that are willing to speak up and tell us what it's about and how to best treat them. While I'm on the topic, I want to hear a little bit from you about your thoughts on, okay, when I was in OT school, they said you have to say individuals with autism. That's how we were trained. That was, I would say, about 20 years ago. And I was recently speaking to a person on the autism spectrum, and he's like, no, just call me autistic. That's what I'm most comfortable with. So I'm curious what your thoughts are on it and what 2025 brings.
Yes, Leah, you played into my hand there, kiddo. So 100%. That's what neurotypical people have said that people with autism want. Person with autism. That's like saying a person with blackness. Why are you separating me from my identity? Like, it's dismissive. I personally, understanding neurotypical linguistics is not something that I'm very good at. So where if you want to call me a person with autism, I don't really care. But I would never call myself that. I would call myself autistic. I can't do anything or see any part of the world without an autistic lens. It's like having brown eyes. I wouldn't say I'm a person with brown eyes. I would just say I have brown eyes or a brown eyed person. I don't particularly care. Like, I'm not going to die on that hill, which I think is a metaphor that is working. I'm not good at this, or an idiom. Also, the Gen Zers will eat you up. Like, those kids know what they want, and they do not want to be called a person with autism. So, yeah, I always ask. 99% of the time, people want to be called autistic. Oftentimes, their parents prefer they have a child with autism. It is distancing language, and if that's what the parent feels comfortable with, I'll use that with the parent and the other with the child. It's all about where the charge is. And again, I do think that we never would have come up with person with autism if autistic people were making the roles. But I was taught that way in nursing school too. Like, you know, identity first language.
Isn't it fascinating? It's very fascinating because I remember our ethics course, and you know that it's an individual. They're an individual. They're not, you know, they're not autistic. And it's very interesting to hear from an individual with an autistic person, like what your view is on it and how you feel about it. And like, it's important for us neurotypical people to hear your perspective. And like, I give you a big shout out for getting on today and sharing it all with us.
Yeah, it's almost like saying, this drives me nuts. When people would be like, oh, well, like you barely have autism. Like, I wouldn't even know. And it's like, can you not like dismiss the fact that the world is hard for me all the time in various ways? And I think that when you say person with autism, for me, it's like it's with me sometimes. Like, I'm a person with a dog who's with me sometimes. And it's not, it's with me all the time. But that said, we can't be, you know, what I try to teach my kids is we can't be so sensitive to language that we lose the capacity to connect to other people. Don't make that a reason to not like somebody. If they can't figure that out without you explaining it to them, it's okay. It doesn't mean they're a bad person. It just means they haven't talked to somebody with autism.
And really, that or I do think that we have to empower our children to voice what it is that they're thinking, because I always tell I have one of my daughters, and she's like, you didn't know what I was thinking? How did you not know what I was thinking? And I always say, I'm not a mentalist. I can't get in there. You got to communicate. And as parents, as educators, as therapists, I do think that we do have high levels of respect for children. And that's why we're in the fields that we're in. And that's why we are parents. And we really do want to respect every single individual. But sometimes voicing it and saying what your wants and needs are, and not feeling inferior and not feeling like I don't have a voice and I can't say what I want, you know, is important so that you could educate people and you could feel more comfortable in your world. Because I don't think anyone cares how we're saying what we're saying. It's more a matter of what we were taught and how we were taught incorrectly.
And also, if with a lot of the adults I work with, who have grown up, who got diagnosed young or in their 40s now, that went through old school ABA, they don't trust a single thing that they're thinking because they've been told that everything they're thinking is wrong. They aren't holding the fork right. They aren't having a conversation right. They aren't introducing themselves right. They need to be taught every single thing. So now here you're 40 years old, you're on your own, and you haven't had a friend since college because you don't trust that you understand how anything works. So being able to, wanting your kid to be a strong advocate is really important. Not giving them a mixed message of be a strong advocate, but also comply and learn everything the way we want you to learn it so that you can look normal. It's really important not to give that paradoxical message to 12-year-olds.
Exactly. And I am actually currently going to school to be a behavioral analysis as well. And, I run a company that provides ABA services. And I said, hey, I'm in this for so long. I need to go and get educated. And I'm currently going through the education process of what behavior analysts are learning. And currently, they are talking about client-centered goals, talking to the parents about goals that parents find important, looking at the child not only as a child, but the context and understanding their environment and picking meaningful goals for your child. So I do think that 2025, we are moving towards, we're moving away. We've heard the voice of autistic people, and we are moving towards creating goals and plans for these children that will support them as people. And I do think that's important for parents and for children to voice what it is they want so that when they are making the treatment plans, it's supportive of that individual. Yes, obviously, as practitioners, we come in and there are certain skills such as self-feeding, self-dressing, being able to be in a setting with other individuals, which our brains do go right away to of how can this individual fit into his world and help that individual best succeed. But I do think therapists of today want to hear the goals of the child, the goals of the parents. And it's important for parents to speak up and prior to saying, oh, the therapy is not good or not, you know, find the right therapist that's willing to listen to you and willing to meet the goals of your children. And if you come across a practitioner that isn't saying this, move right along. There are other ones out there that will support your child. So don't put your child in therapy that you feel like they're just, you know, bopping them on the head, bopping them on the head, bopping them on the head for doing things that is who they are. No, research the therapy, research where you're placing your child because you have that power. There are good therapies out there. Maybe 20 years ago, we didn't have the same, but I think today we have enough practitioners out there that are being educated currently with the current, you know, education system. And I'm an occupational therapist, so I had a lot to say about BCBAs and ABA therapists prior to going through the schooling. And, you know, that's a big reason I opened my ABA practice was I wanted to provide a therapy for children on the autism spectrum that are not that is not bopping them on the head, that is not suppressing who they are, but rather supporting them as individuals in this world and helping them be the best them that they could be. But as I'm going through the schooling, I'm like, hey, you know what? They are really talking to therapists about all these wonderful, you know, I'm a student currently, and they're talking about all these wonderful ideals that we all support. So making sure that your therapist is giving you and your child that kind of therapy where you feel supported and you feel your child's in a good environment, you could advocate. You should advocate.
So one thing that you can potentially do too is to ask your child, what do you think your therapist likes about you? And they should have ideas. And if it's that I listen to them or that I do what they ask, that's not the right therapist for your kid. Your child needs to be with a therapist who genuinely enjoys them, who genuinely likes them, not because they can train them, but because of who they are. And I think that's a problem. That's one of the things I see when kids come into me that's really different. They'll say, she really likes me. And it's like, I do. I genuinely like the kids I work with. Like, they're all really unique and quirky, and I love learning about their special interests, and it amazes me the things they can do. And I love having the opportunity to normalize that asymmetrical learning of like, yeah, you can't tie your shoes. So what? You can tell me the height of any roller coaster in the country. Who can do that? That's amazing. You'll tie your shoes later, or you'll just wear Velcro or slip-ons. It's not a big deal. Like, this is really nothing to lose any self-esteem points over. Or being able to self-disclose. Yeah, I couldn't tie my shoes. I didn't know my left from my right till sixth grade. It's okay. It doesn't mean you're stupid. It doesn't mean there isn't a place. It doesn't mean that you're not worthy of connection, love, and friendship. It's just part of who you are, and that's all right. So, yeah. I
love that perspective. I really do. And I think it's very empowering both to parents and to autistic individuals. Okay, so we're getting towards the end, but I still have like one or two topics I must still hit. So you tell me if you need to buzz out at any point. But tell us a little bit about your advocacy that you're doing in the autism world, what your passion is there, what you really feel needs to get out to the world.
Thank you. I love being able to talk to I have a gig coming up at Keystone Camp in Brevard, North Carolina. It's a large girls camp that's ages 7 to 16. And I did it last year. They asked me to come back this year. And I love that they were looking for an autistic presenter. They sought me out on purpose because they wanted somebody with autism to talk to their counselors and staff, which made me super happy. But I love being able to teach folks that are working with children, not how to identify autism, but how to identify that something might not be them giving you a hard time. It might be them having a hard time. It's like teaching the ability to be compassionate by giving insight into, oh, well, if they really don't want to leave one activity, what is it about the next activity? Oh, the next activity is right for me? Maybe they have some issues with the sound, maybe that's not a good fit for a kid on the spectrum. There's a lot of sequencing involved in safety when it comes to handling a firearm. We're not traditionally good at knowing what order things come in. So having a what if you had somebody being a one-on-one with them where they were with them helping each step of the way, like prepping for each thing that comes next. And I love the fact that with those kinds of audiences, almost every time I'll have people come up and say, I think I'm autistic. I never thought about it before. I just knew I was different, but I didn't know what kind of different I was. And sometimes they're in tears. And sometimes they're more in their logical brains. But either way, that idea of creating a place where someone is normal and belongs and teaching other people how to do that for folks on the spectrum. How do you just make, because if you make something inclusive, it's not about giving people with autism a way for them to do it. It's about giving everybody a way that works for everybody. I'm sure you've maybe seen that cartoon where it's like the snowstorm, there's snow that's fallen at a school and the janitor is shoveling the snow off the steps, and the kid in the wheelchair is like, can you shovel the ramp? And he's like, no, I got to finish the steps because there's more kids that use the steps. And he's like, but everybody could use the ramp. It's that. It's a finding the ramp. Finding a way to get people to shovel the ramp, if that's not metaphorical.
I love that.
We're all, we all just want to belong and to feel like we have purpose. You can give a child a task that doesn't need to be done. If it's something they can do, they don't need to know it doesn't need to be done. Find ways to be able to help us participate.
Support, make us feel good, give us things that fit within our skill set. And there is plenty in that skill set. So
yeah, there's a positive story.
Find it, support it.
When I worked at summer camp, we had a week that was level 2. So more affected, more support needs. We have a young man who his special interest was weather. So every day, I said we swim 3 times a day. If there was a storm coming, we would have him tell us about the storm that was coming. And he made the decision as to whether or not it was safe to get in the pool. He was the best person to make that decision. He was 12, but he was still the best person to make that decision because he knew the most about it. But he would give all the entire camp. He would justify why the choice was if it was stormy weather. And it was great. Everybody won. He got to talk about his special interest. He got to have a place of authority. We got to make really informed decisions about whether or not to put the kids in the water. You know, there are ways where it's just a benefit. And finding those opportunities, because you can't find one in every situation. So if there's a situation where you can find an opportunity to let especially a child shine that's used to being not enough or different, or not any, or the kid who no one wants to do group work with, figure out a way to do it. And like, let me help you. Like, we can figure out ways for these kids to feel like they fit. It might be a little bit of extra effort on the front end, but you're going to come up with a much better end result for everybody, not just for the kid on the spectrum. So that's what I love doing.
Love that. Love that. Okay, amazing. So we're winding down here. Is there any last positive message you would want to share with our listeners today? You gave us such amazing input and insight into the autistic brain. And I even feel like you gave us a lot of also good tips that we could implement today and good perspective taking. So thank you for all of that. Fascinating. Go ahead and tell us what you'd leave us off with.
I think I would leave us off with the world is changing at an incredibly rapid rate. The U.S. is changing at an incredibly rapid rate. Brain types, you know, we just had a whole generation that is affected by COVID. People having different brains is going to be the norm rather than the exception in the not-so-distant future. Like, hang in there. There's new medications coming out. There's new treatments coming out. The resources that are available to you right now, today, when your child is whatever age they are, aren't the resources that are going to be available when your child is an adult. There will be more choices and more options. So try to just, I know you're going to worry. Parents worry. And that's okay. But also don't forget that there are a lot of good things coming. And there are a lot of people who want to love your children exactly as they are.
Love that. Thank you, Kara. You were so amazing. This was such a phenomenal, interesting podcast. It did not even go in the direction that we thought. I have my notes here of the things I'm going to ask, but these are the best ones when we have good spicy debate going on, and you did a great job. So I'm so excited for it to come out. It probably won't come out for like another 2-3 months because it goes in like the order that I recorded it in. But as soon as it does, we're going to share it with you. And I think it's going to be an amazing voice to everybody. I love the topics. Thank you.
And if can I put in one more? So since we've dismantled the suicide hotline in the US, if you teach your child to text 741-741, the word home, a therapist will come on and text with them. It doesn't have to be suicide. It can just be that your child is upset or feeling like an outsider or not connected. They don't have to talk. They don't have to say their names. They're not being tracked. As long as they're safe, it's fun. Like, you know, so even if it's like somebody at school was really mean to me, if you can't afford therapy or you don't have the time to get your kid to therapy because you're just trying to get by, 741-741, home, hand your kid the phone. Like, they need to talk. And there are still resources, and if you can somehow splice that in, I feel like it's really important.
Oh, yeah, we'll put it in. That's perfect. You know, it is really important. Thank you. Thank you for sharing that. The one topic I didn't touch on that I was hoping to is the medication piece, as far as like when you actually think medication is appropriate and quick thoughts on it?
Yeah, sure. If you can get in. So, yeah, most of the parents that I work with, when their kids are younger, haven't medicated them. Maybe not most. I would say maybe 40%. When puberty hits, that can change. There's just a lot more social expectation, a lot more opportunity to feel othered, like an outsider, and depression can happen. If you have a child who's no longer interested in their special interest, that's a huge problem. Like, that means that their brain has given up on, like, trying to get the happy chemicals. We need to find a way to subsidize those happy chemicals. If your kid is only playing video games and going to school and nothing else, we also have a dopamine dysregulation issue, a physiological dopamine issue that likely needs to be corrected with medication. And when I say corrected, that's strong. We can't fix, in air quotes, the autistic brain to be a neurotypical brain. But what we can do is have symptom management. If a child is a threat to themselves or others, like if they've started cutting, or if they've started kind of taking some of their frustration out on the fact that they're bigger than a sibling, that's another time where you may want to discuss medication with a physician or prescriber. My preference is NPs, but
your preference is in what?
My preference for prescribers is nurse practitioners, because they have usually worked in the setting with people on the spectrum, as opposed to psychiatrists, where there's never a unit of people with autism, like in no hospital. Well, maybe now, but I don't know of it. But with nurse practitioners, they've spent time following patients, so seeing what works, what doesn't work, understanding why life is hard. It's not a 15-minute session where you're in for, are your meds working, are they not working? If you have proprioception issues, if you have interoception issues, if you can't tell what your body feels like, you don't know if your meds are working. So yeah, that's something I can really probably help people understand better. That could be, I do med consults all the time for folks. I can't prescribe, I can't suggest, but I can tell you what the new things are. And potential long-term side effects, like nurses are trained in medication education. But yeah, if your child's not having any joy in their lives, they're not going to learn how to do that when they get older. It's not likely anyway. Getting some of the things that are related to that atypical wiring in our brains out of the way, or trying to, by decreasing our capacity to process information so that we're not getting bombarded by all this data, all this, you know, literally noise, can be really helpful to, it can free up the energy to connect to the world, which we need connection. We're pack species, like we're pack animals. So yeah,
it's not, we got to be able to connect. And if we're seeing
is that just about performance?
You're freezing up.
You know, it's not like a lot of people will take their kids off. Med breaks are your own choice, but off medications in the summer. And then like the second day, they're off their Adderall, they go to the summer camp. Where it's all new people, all new situation. It's not just a study drug. It's to help us socially connect as well, to focus on things besides our special interests, to where we can have a conversation and feel comfortable in it. There's a lot of social benefits from meds as well. It's not just about conformity. Sleeping. So many people on the spectrum have sleep issues. It's like 82% of us. Doesn't have to be a med. It can be sleep hygiene rituals, but sleep hygiene rituals are really hard to maintain with a 15-year-old. But we have to sleep. Like that's one of the big ones.
All children need to sleep, and it's important to be able to figure that piece out. And you're saying sometimes medication could help it if you can't solve it. But, you know, you should obviously try the sleep hygiene, but sometimes it.
And there can be, like, for folks on the spectrum, sometimes they need a screen to fall asleep. Sometimes I do if I'm very dysregulated. Just make sure I can help you find what is something that your child can fall asleep to that's not upregulating for their brain. Everybody's different. And, like, I've trained in supplements as well. So I do supplements with some folks that you can usually dial it in with supplements for the younger kids. It takes a little while. But it takes a little while with meds too, and try not to be discouraged, because the average, not for autism, but in general, it's 5 med changes till you find the one that works. Wow. And for folks on the spectrum, my experience as well, as we age, we kind of cycle through meds. Like, they work for a while and then they don't work. There's some new meds coming out, like Auvelity, that is an antidepressant but works completely different than any of the other antidepressants. It modulates the glutamate system. Glutamate is where autistic brains have issues. It works for me. I can't give medical advice, but I can tell you my story. It has changed my life. It didn't exist on the market until 2 years ago. So just knowing what your choices are don't be afraid to talk to someone about medication. It doesn't mean you have to start medication. It just means you have more information about medication. And that's definitely something that I love doing. If it's a specific medication, if you want to find me on my website, and I'll do a short on YouTube about the med. But, and also, don't take advice from other parents about how their kids responded to meds, because their kid isn't your kid. And you don't know what their struggles are at home, and you don't know what other meds they're on, and you don't know how those interact, and you don't know what supplements they're on, and you don't know their sleep schedule. It's not the same. I understand wanting comfort and reassurance, but it's not any useful information to know how a med has worked for another family.
And I like the patience piece that you brought up too, that sometimes we think like meds are then a quick fix, but really giving it time and writing journals and documenting like the start and through the trial process and committing to a certain amount of time and seeing if it works. I found a lot of journal taking to be very important in all therapy treatments, really, where you write what the behavior is ahead of time and what, like how it's displaying. And then, sometimes we kind of even forget what the issue was and how bad it was once we're in a better place. And then it's hard to sort of gauge, like our minds are a cool place and we do have an amazing memory, but sometimes our memory, it happens gradual over time and it's hard to remember what happened and how bad it was, how often it was, what the exact behavior was. And then why we kind of forget why we did that. And so just documenting. And sometimes when you document, you'll see there wasn't really much of a change. And then you're going to take, switch to the next medication or go off the medication. But really keeping a journal of behavior and how it's changed or of the target, whatever it is that you're looking to change. If you document, it's really helpful to yourself to remember.
And I have anybody who wants one, just shoot me an email through the website. I've put together it. I give it to all my pediatric patients. It's a pediatric medication tracking list. So it tracks symptoms. There's a column for each day for 90 days. And you grade the symptom like a 1 to 5. And then it also tracks potential side effects for the medication. So because the medication can be helping and hurting at the same time. And that's still probably not the right fit. Physiological symptoms as well. So it's one piece of paper that you can just like go down in the column and score for the day. And you can look back 3 months in and see without having to take a whole lot of notes. It's a quick tool. And I've been tweaking it for about a decade. So I think it's pretty useful. And I'm always open to corrections or things that should be added. But yeah, it's journaling sometimes can be time consuming. And this is kind of the idea behind it, is to take the time out of the journaling and just be able to put it on the refrigerator and quick fill it in at the end of the day. So you can look back and know if it is helping, because it's really important what you just said.
Okay. Amazing. Thank you. Okay. You were so informative. Thank you so, so much. I'm looking forward to getting published and really you were just like a wealth of knowledge right there. So thank you. Thank you.